Hello and welcome to another episode of Inside OSU. I'm Dr. Kenneth Sewell, Vice President for Research here at OSU. Our scientists and scholars at OSU are conducting cutting-edge research in a wide array of fields, placing OSU among the nation's top tier of research universities. Even still, our amazing research can be hard for the public to know about on an everyday basis, as it's not quite as visible as OSU's highly ranked degree programs or championship athletic teams. Well, this episode of Inside OSU is going to raise the veil on at least one research area I think you'll find fascinating. In today's podcast, you'll sit in on a recent OSU Research on Tap event, a monthly interview show I host at Stillwater's Iron Monk Brewery. In this episode, my guest is Dr. Mark Perry from the Michael and Ann Greenwood School of Music. Dr. Perry's expertise is wide-ranging, from specific composers from Spain and Latin America to the roots and cultural importance of modern electronic dance music. Our conversation focuses on the history and cultural meaning of two national dances from the Catalonian region of Spain. Well, let's join the interview.
So musicology is the study of music. It's not necessarily the performance of the music, but the study of music. And initially, in the early days, musicology focused on music as an object. But today, we look at music in its entirety within society, the musicians, the audience, and the historical past. Ethnomusicology is a subfield, and it sometimes is known as the anthropology of music. And so it's looking at music sort of through the lens of anthropology. And many cases, ethnomusicologists are anthropologists or graduate from anthropology programs. So in graduate school, I took classes in both anthropology and musicology.
So from a historical perspective or an anthropological perspective, are you studying the impact of culture or history on music or vice versa, the impact of music on culture and history?
It's both.
It's both.
So it's looking at both how music impacts society, but how music and how society impacts music. So it goes both ways.
Now, in a minute, we're going to get into this national dance thing, because I'm going to have to figure out what that is and why Spain or Catalonia, the area of Spain, has two of these things. And as far as I can tell, I'm not sure that we have even one here in the U.S. But first, I want to get a picture of how you go about doing this research as a musicologist. So
when I'm doing work in ethnomusicology, I go out and conduct field work, which means going. My area of specialty is the Catalan-speaking region of Spain, so it involves me going out there for long periods of time. I mean, now that they're months or 2 months or 3 months, but before, it would be a year or so. And then that's also my first two degrees are from Spain, so I spent quite a bit of time there. It basically means being a participant in the culture that I'm studying. Depending on what aspect of Catalan culture I'm looking at, I'm inserting myself within the culture and participating.
And so in many instances, that means learning the language,
yeah.
You certainly did that.
Yeah.
But from a musical standpoint, does that mean to some extent learning the musical language of
the
culture?
So sometimes in the field of ethnomusicology, it's known as bimusicality or multimusicality. So one of the things that you do is you learn to play the musical instruments of that particular culture. So when I was living in Spain, I studied flamenco guitar. Even though flamenco is more of a music of the southern part of Spain, but lots of Spaniards from the south moved to Barcelona and that region and brought with them flamenco music. So I learned to play flamenco, and then also studied classical guitar, and then when I studied dance, it meant actually going out and learning how to do the dances and participating in those dances.
Okay. Now, what constitutes a national dance?
Okay,
what is that?
Well,
we have a national song. We're talking about something officially
right.
named by the government to be the national?
No, this is, yes and no.
Okay.
So this region of Spain, the Catalonia, they want... Many, I'm not saying all, but many want to separate and become an independent nation. And so these dances are sort of markers of identity that sort of are clearly marking themselves as being different from the rest of Spain. Spain's extremely a diverse country. So the dances I've been looking at are ones that the Catalan people themselves see as very important to dance and recognize it as being a national dance. So in the area of dance, there's the text isn't that important because it's dance music. But other songs where they carry a text, being in Catalan is very important.
Yeah. Being in the language of
being Catalan. In Catalan, yeah. Yeah.
Now, so does a national dance serve a different purpose as an expression than dance does in general, or is it only a matter of degree in some way?
Well, these dances probably, and this is just a guess, but probably wouldn't be around today if they weren't tied to nationalism.
To nationalism.
Yeah. So it's the fact that you dance it is basically it's an outward statement that you are Catalan and not Castilian, and part of it was during the dictatorship, the Franco dictatorship. The dancing Franco and his dictatorship didn't see the dancing of these traditional dances as being any threat to the nation of Spain, and so that was about one of the only ways that one could be Catalan outwardly was to dance it, because there was periods of time where the Catalan language was forbidden to be spoken or printed, so these dances were one way that you could go out into the general public and say I'm a Catalan, and so. And even after the dictatorship, it continues to be important, a sort of marker of identity, although more for the older generation than the younger generation.
Gotcha. Yeah. So describe these dances. I mean, they're two particular ones.
Okay, so one is today is still a dance, but the other one that I studied it's called a castel.
A castel.
And I think none of us in this room, myself included, would call it a dance anymore, but it started off being a dance. And so the castel, it literally means sort of castle, but we usually translate it as human tower. And it's basically, you have very large people at the very bottom, and they create what's called a piña, which is pineapple. And then they get on each other's shoulders, and they tend to be a little bit larger people. And then as they get up, they're teenagers. And at the very top, there's usually about, you know, 3 8-year-olds or, you know, really young kids, usually a little young girl. But in its early history, before the castel, it was a dance that men would do, and they would create these castles, and, you know, sort of almost like a circus, and they would move around. It was they would create these castles of maybe 2 stories or 3 stories tall, but it could move around. And as it got so big, it's 5 or 6 stories tall, and you can't dance when you have that many people.
So hard to move around and not drop people.
But that's actually, in my current research, that tends to be the most emblematic of Catalan identity now. Whenever you go to a major sort of festival or that expresses Catalan identity, it's usually the castells. Then the other dance is the sardana, which is a round dance. And traditionally, it should be danced man, woman, man, woman, man, woman. And the fact that they dance it in a circle holding hands, it represents solidarity and also equality among the sexes, equality among those who dance it. And it's a circle dance. What's really interesting, if you go, they still dance this in Barcelona and other parts. They will, if you go to the a public dance of the sardana, people will drop, like if you had a purse, you'd put it in the middle. And it's perfect because it's the focal point. So the circle, when you're dancing it, you're going a perfect circle, but also you can watch your purse. I've even seen people put their dogs, and the dog will just sit there and it has 2 sort of dance steps. They call them courts and yargs. Court is short, yarg is long. And depending on which section of the dance, you either raise your hands up or you lower your hands. I know that doesn't seem like a big deal to us, but if you raise your arms in the wrong place, that's not a good thing. In fact, there was actually a book published on whether you should have your arms lowered or lowered or raised during this dance in different parts.
An entire book published on that.
It's a thin book, but
Those who aren't part of OSU might ask if someone got tenured based on that.
No, but I do have that book. I think I have, for the state of Oklahoma, I might have the most books on the sardana. Yeah,
that may be true. So what is the relationship between these dances to music? You mentioned I mean, the style may not even be recognizable to many of us as thinking what a dance typically is, but there's still music associated here. What is their connectedness to music?
So what's really interesting about the Castell, if you ever get a chance, and if you ever travel to Catalonia, if you see some festivities, you might see this Castell, but they only play one melody. The whole repertoire for building castells, they only play one melody, and it's called Toc de Castell. Toc is melody. And basically, its purpose is to tell the people building the castell where they are in the building stage. Because if you're, just think about it, you know, you have three or four stories of people above you, the last thing you can do is look up and then have it come down on you. Or, you know, if you're struggling, but you know that you just have a little more to go, you can do it. And so the melodies are basically saying, hey, we're on the first story, the second, and then it's sort of like a rodeo. The little girl will do this, and they will signal that they've done it.
So this is with the melody itself, mm-hmm. not lyrics or
no, no lyrics, no lyrics. Just it's a graia, which is an oboe, and then snare drums, and there are lots of graia, so it's very loud. And each of the castell builders bring their own musicians. So
they really are in communication.
Yeah, they're in communication. Yeah, so it's very, because it's very important. And then when you build the castell, for it to be considered successful, you actually have to disassemble it without it crashing down as well. And so the music plays a role in that, in motivating, but also allowing people to know where the stages are.
So much of dance, as we typically engage in it in this culture, we're dancing to music.
Right.
And in many ways, this is a dance that the music is to it.
Somehow. Right. Yeah. So that was what I found fascinating, was the fact that the music is in response to what they're doing, not the other way around. So it's exactly as you stated.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of what we think.
And then the Sardana are very different, though.
The Sardana, what's interesting about the Sardana, it's in two parts, the Kurz and Yargs. They're two sections. And remember, you have to know which one to have your hands raised or lowered, but you also have to know exactly how many measures each of those sections are. So when you're dancing, you're going one, two, three, four, and you know, can go up to a really high number. And then the second time you repeat it, based on that number that you counted, you apply this mathematical formula, and then you end on the right foot in the right place. And so it's actually quite complicated. You always know when you see people dancing the Sardana, there's usually one person that actually counts it out, will actually, you know, probably shout out, you know, this is how many measures there were. So it's the only dance that I know of where you actually have to count the number of measures in the music.
So does it have to be a particular song or a particular structure of a song to support it?
It's just the number of measures.
It just
the Sardana has a typical rhythm to it. But what you're counting are...
It can be the melody of what's being played.
Yeah,
can be.
In the early days, sometimes they would take traditional or operatic melodies and turn it into a Sardana. And today, people still compose Sardanas, original Sardanas, not as often as they once did. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned that one of these dances is still very much in play, and the other maybe not so much. But
they're both.
Tell us how about that identity piece. Because being Catalonian is not quite as suppressed. It still has its...
It's not suppressed at all.
Yeah.
Well, that's, yeah. I take that back.
Maybe a little bit. But
the president is outside
maybe
the country.
President would like it.
And there's some people in prison now. But, what's interesting, when I go back, you know, when I did my research many, many years ago in the late 80s, early 90s, there was the Catalan flag was common. It's yellow with the four red stripes. But now you see the one that has the blue star on it. And when I was in the late 80s, early 90s, that was very taboo. That was like almost, not terrorist, but it was associated with Spain, you know, had its issues with terrorism. And that was sort of taboo. But now if you go to Barcelona, you'll see that flag everywhere. In fact, I have 10 shoes that have that Catalan flag, the separatist flag on it. And actually, if you go into my office, you'll see a separatist flag in my office as well.
So there are other ways for Catalonian people to kind of express their national aspirations and identity.
Right, the primary is language.
Language.
So now oftentimes when I go to Barcelona or any other of the Catalan-speaking regions, I'll come back not speaking any Spanish. I could go the whole time there just speaking Catalan.
The University of Barcelona is completely Catalonian, is it not?
Well, not, I would say 99%.
I mean the classroom language.
It should be.
It's supposed to be.
I mean, for the most part, I mean, all my classes were always in Catalan when I was there. So now, I mean, the Catalan language is very dominant. And so if you want to be an employee of the government, you have to demonstrate that you have a competency in Catalan. So it's almost the opposite.
So do these dances then risk being, my parents used to do that.
Yeah.
So how are they staying alive?
That's one of the things I'm studying. This is actually a very long period of research that I'm doing, because it's basically my research started in the late 80s, and I periodically go back, and the last time I went back, it was a couple years ago, and I noticed that I had a hard time finding dancing of the Sardana. Part of it was the time of year, but when I went to it was everybody was at least 50 or older, and probably much older than that. There weren't very many young people. The only young people were the musicians.
I'm sorry, over 50 is not old. clarify that for the record.
In my early days,
let the record show.
In my early days, it showed more diversity as far as age, but now it tends to be people that grew up during the dictatorship and know what the what it was like before.
Franco regime.
Yeah. The young people today some of them are unaware of how different it was. Yeah. And so I do notice that the way that older people dance and the way the younger generation dance is very different. Younger people, they have what's called they're called collas, and they're these competitions of dance groups, and it's a club. And so you meet once or twice a week and you practice dancing the Sardana. And then on the weekends, you go to these Sardana competitions. But what happens is they're wearing these costumes that are kind of folkloric, and they are very rigid when they dance, and it's very precise. It's not like how you would see it when you go and see people dancing the Sardana in a traditional way. So the older generations, they like to dance the Sardana for the enjoyment of it, and it's the meaning behind it. But the young generation, they want to get trophies and hang out with friends. It's less. I mean, it's still there's the Catalan identity that's associated with it.
It's more of an athletic performance in a weird way.
It's very athletic, actually.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. I sort of embedded myself into one sort of dance group. It was sort of a middle class group, there was one. I was still a graduate student when I was doing it, so I made lots of mistakes. But I remember one of the kids there, he was dancing, but I noticed that he was speaking Castilian to all of his colleagues, and so I immediately targeted that. I said, that's interesting, and immediately he tried to speak Catalan, but it was not very good. But it was a way for him, as sort of like a first-generation Catalan, to sort of acquire that Catalan identity. He didn't have the language skills. I mean, you could if you spoke Catalan with him, you'd know that that's not his first language. But he was dancing a Catalan dance.
In some ways could... maybe not master, but could be a full participant in that prior to being a full participant in the language group.
So it's and still very popular today in sort of the competition side.
Is there a danger with the rigidity of the competition side in the sense of, if the dance becomes something that no one can put their personal inflection on, might it become a relic?
Well, it is becoming what I'm describing, sort of almost like a museum piece, where folkloricism, and this happens in lots of European countries, where they take dances, and they wear the costumes, and then the choreography becomes fixed, and it's a museum piece. But what's very interesting about the competition sardanas, they allow for this one sardana to be danced anew with new choreography. But the only rule is that they can't break their hands. That's the only thing. They still have to form a circle, but the footsteps, the choreography is newly invented.
Newly invented. So they can.
So that allows them to
reinterpret the sardana.
And so they can express their. And then another sardana that they have is called Rivesa, and it's they commission a sardana just for that competition. That is, no one's ever heard the sardana ever before. They play it, and the dancers have to know how many measures exactly each section is. But it's written in such a way that it's kind of hard to figure that out. And when you watch them dance it, they're like this, and they're all counting, they're communicating with each other, and when they think they know the right number, they spread out into that circle, and then if they end with the right choreography, it's clear that they mastered being able to count. And so that's also not something, it's not a traditional sardana.
Yeah.
But it's there to maintain that skill that yeah. that people think are is important about the sardana, the fact that you have to count the number of measures.
So. Where do you see your research headed? And I say that in the broadest sense. We're talking about this line of research mm-hmm. tonight, but I know I've kind of put you in a straitjacket to talk about one line of research because you've got so many things yeah. going. Where is your research headed in the future?
Well, I do a lot of research within clubs, dance clubs around the world, and most of my research has been in Spain. But I think one of the things where I'm going to start branching off is heavy metal festivals in the Nordic region of Europe. And so I'll continue to do stuff that's related to dance and dance clubs, but I think I'm going to start moving into sort of, because it's very interesting when you're in Finland, the number of Finnish heavy metal bands per capita is a very strange number, and the national character of Finnish people should not match the metal character, but
maybe it's quite the opposite in some way.
When I've studied metal in sort of like Central Europe, it was very different and actually quite scary. But when I'm in Finland, it's actually a very open,
congenial environment.
Yeah. So I think I'll continue to do work. As far as dance music and dance clubs.
So between your research, which is in dance clubs and so forth, and at least some of your passion/business, which involves being a DJ in
right.
dance clubs, how many nights a year are you in a dance club?
Before I came to Oklahoma, quite frequently. But
are you suggesting we don't have that many dance clubs
no,
in Oklahoma?
No, you don't, actually. Yeah. So where I was before, I was near Atlanta, so it would be on the every weekend.
I hope you enjoyed that. I sure did. You can find out about future OSU Research on Tap events and attend them live. Just follow us on Facebook or go to the research.okstate.edu website. And you can view our archived installments on OState TV. Just go to Research in the About OSU section. And that's it for this episode. I'm Dr. Kenneth Sewell. Join us next week for another Inside OSU podcast.